holography in cases where there are boundary fluids that have vorticity. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to consider several fixed bulk geometries. One of the things that is kind of common in the literature is that people define some hydrodynamics in the boundary theory and then try to deduce what sort of bulk geometry would be required to reproduce that hydrodynamics. I'm going to take the opposite point of view. I'm just going to fix a bulk geometry, and I'm just going to study what hydrodynamic features it has, or what features of the boundary theory has. And as I said, I'm going to consider several different bulk geometries. And what we're going to end up with, well, I must say that this is sort of a work in progress. So I don't think we have a complete picture yet. But one way to view what we have here is just a rotating fluid. Maybe it's essentially a perfect fluid. Maybe it consists of like a Bose or a Fermi gas, something like that. But we also, basically what I'm going to do in the talk is I'm going to try to amass some evidence that in certain cases, the way that you should think about the boundary theory is really in terms of sort of analog gravity, okay, where what the boundary theory is doing for you is really describing some sort of acoustics or optics in rotating media. Okay, and the reason that we get there is that one of the geometries that I'm going to study in some detail is the Lorentzian Taubnut geometry, which has some famous conceptual classical problems. It has closed time-like curves, for example. It has Misner string singularity. One of the motivations for this work was to ask the question, could it be that such a geometry that's apparently sick in these ways from the bulk point of view, could it still be given a sensible holographic interpretation? Okay. And that's where this analog gravity idea is going to come in. So as I said, I'm going to try to give you pieces of evidence for that. Okay, so just to get everybody on the same page, we're going to be considering here 3+1 dimensional asymptotically ADS backgrounds. Okay, there's a 2+1 holographic dual then. And that dual has a set of boundary data that you get through the Pfefferman-Gram expansion, as I'll explain in some detail in a moment. But in particular, you get a boundary frame, or a metric, and you also get a boundary stress current, or an energy momentum tensor, as is probably familiar to everyone. Now, in the cases that we're going to study here, most of the cases we're going to study, the fluid that you find in the boundary is a near perfect fluid, and it contains vorticity. Okay, so it's a rotating fluid. So I'm going to consider three examples here: ADS Schwarzschild, which is a familiar example; ADS Kerr, which corresponds to a simple rotating fluid, as we'll see; and as I said, I'm going to consider the ADS Taubnut solution as well. Okay, so all these things share some properties. They're stationary and axially symmetric. Okay, so I'm thinking in terms of a bottom-up approach to holography. I'm not thinking about some string or M-theory model, but these bulk geometries are asymptotically ADS, as we said, with a cosmological constant. And I'll use coordinates where the asymptotic conformal boundary is at r equals infinity. Okay, and so if we look at the asymptotic expansion of the metric in the bulk, it contains, as usual, information about the metric that's induced on the boundary, as well as the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor, of the dual field theory. And in this talk, I'm going to, for reasons that'll become clear, I'm going to use the sort of the Palatini formalism, or I'm going to typically concentrate on coframes and connections rather than metrics, but it's easy to pass back and forth. And to orient you, the metric, we're going to think of the metric as being in this form. This is a sort of Pfefferman-Graham form. It may or may not be the usual coordinates that you're used to for these various examples. But we have a coframe here, which I'm going to call capital E in the bulk at least. And you can study this by doing a radial slicing, by taking constant R hypersurfaces. And this coframe in the bulk is then determined, if you write the asymptotic Pfefferman-Graham expansion, there are two one-forms here that appear in the expansion that I'll call little e and f. And all, as usual, all of the subleading terms are determined in terms of those. Okay, so this capital F is, you should think of as determined. And sometimes that has interesting geometric, it does have interesting geometric interpretations as well. So EA here is the orthonormal basis of one forms in the boundary. And FA encodes the energy momentum tensor. Okay, and the way that it does that is that, okay, so the F here is really a vector valued one form, and its components in the orthonormal basis are the components of the stress tensor. Okay, so that's the simple way it works. Okay, so if you do this Pfefferman-Graham expansion in all of the examples I'm considering here, you find a metric on the a three metric on the boundary that takes this form. Okay, and so you can read off from that a convenient basis of one forms is as written below. Okay, so the E alphas are, if you like, a spatial basis of one forms that square to this spatial metric, and E zero is dt, but shifted by this one form that I'll call B. And we refer to this frame for reasons that I'll, well, for sort of historical reasons, as the Randers coframe. And this one form B that appeared in E0 we'll refer to as the Randers one form, just to give it a name. Okay, and this nomenclature goes back to ancient times, and we'll see it. We'll see some of the reasons that people were interested in this sort of thing later on. Okay, if you construct the corresponding dual frame of vector fields, then you see that there's a time-like vector field, which is simply d by dt. And what you can conclude from that, then, is that this Randers frame is co-moving. Okay, there's a little calculation to do here, but it's simple. It's a co-moving frame. Okay, and so this boundary data that we're describing here corresponds to a relativistic fluid, but as seen in the description I'm giving you here, it's as seen by a co-moving observer. Okay, we're in a particular frame, and the velocity vector field of that fluid is just, I'll call it U, okay, and it's just that E0 because we're in the co-moving frame. Okay, these kinematical features of the fluid, it's important to understand, are encoded not in the stress tensor piece of the Pfefferman-Graham expansion, but it's really contained in the leading stuff, the metric part. Okay, so also, in all of these examples, what you find is that when you do this Pfefferman-Graham expansion, the stress current, or the energy momentum tensor, takes a perfect fluid form, and it's conformal, right? So that means that the energy density and the pressure are related to one another. The stress tensor is traceless. And So in this orthonormal basis, this corresponds to that result, and you can write that out in the familiar, in the more familiar perfect fluid form if you take the components. Okay, and so what this Randers one form and the spatial metric is doing for you is that if you then construct the one form U dual to the vector field U, you can see that B appears in the spatial component. And if you write out the stress tensor in this coordinate basis, then you see then the Randers one, the components of the Randers one form, for example, appear in these off-diagonal elements. Okay, so a little bit more generally is if I just had a relativistic fluid with a normalized velocity u, in a coordinate basis, we can decompose the covariant derivative of that vector field into various components. Okay, there's an acceleration term. Okay, so I'm using h mu nu here, denotes the projector onto the space transverse to the velocity field. Okay, and then there's an acceleration term. Okay, there's a symmetric traceless part that you can pull out, which is the shear. There's a term proportional to h mu nu with a coefficient theta, which is the trace of the covariant derivative of u. It's the expansion. And then finally, there's the antisymmetric part, omega mu nu, which are the components of the vorticity. Okay, and because it's antisymmetric, you can combine that into it. You can form that into a two form. And it's given by, well, if the acceleration was zero, it would just be given by du. Okay, and generally the fluid can be perfect or not. There's various viscosity type terms that might appear in the stress tensor. Okay, and in the cases that we're considering here, the fluid's inertial, which means the acceleration vanishes. It's shearless and expansionless, which means that some of these other coefficients vanish. And E and P turned out to be constants. And so that viscosity part of the stress tensor just vanishes because these tensor guys are zero. So if you wanted to compute viscosities here, you would have to do it by perturbing the fluid and seeing how it behaves. Okay. And I haven't included possible parity violating effects here because it's not the subject of interest today. Okay, but more generally, we do have vorticity because as I said on the previous transparency, in the absence of acceleration, omega is just du. And this du is just given by the divergence of the exterior derivative of the of this Randers one form.
Showed in the previous slide, didn't we have to choose a particular frame like a Landau frame or something?
This one?
Yes.
Possibly. So there certainly are details of hydrodynamics associated with that. There is a choice of frame that you have to be careful about to eliminate various degrees of freedom. That's not really what I'm interested in here because the stress tensor really, at the order I'm working, the stress tensor is just a perfect fluid, and the only thing that's turned on actually is the vorticity. So I'm trying to give you a general sense, but in all the cases, it's simple.
Can I ask you if you turn? So you, I don't know if you worked hard or it just happened that way that the shear and the expansion went to zero, but if I turn on the vorticity, then at next order in the hydro expansion, I expect that they're dissipative terms.
Yes.
Are we going to see those?
No, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about dissipation. That's a hard calculation. and it's not the subject of the talk, but it is something.
That somehow, doesn't it have to be a part of what holography gives you?
Eventually, yes.
Okay.
So as I'm going to show you, there are, at least in the TabNet case, there are some interpretational problems that you should get straight before you go on to consider dissipation. But certainly that's something that, you know, assuming that we'll get those problems sorted out, that's something that we definitely want to study. But it's a much harder problem. Well, it's...
Okay, so one way to think about this vorticity is that it's sort of the analog of a magnetic field, in that it appears, one way that it's like a magnetic field is that it appears in the Pfefferman-Gram expansion in the same place as a magnetic field does if you have a gauge field in the bulk. Right? So here's a gauge field in four dimensions expanded a la Pfefferman-Gram, and the subleading term gives you it's the expectation value of the charge current. In particular, the zero component, the time component, gives you the charge density. The time component of the leading term is like a chemical potential, as it turns out. And if you want to turn on a magnetic field in the boundary, then that's done by making the spatial components of this leading component have a curl. Okay, so that's, if you think back to how I described vorticity, that's very similar. And this analog between vorticity and magnetic fields, in fact, runs very deep. In fact, there are recent experiments on rotating superfluids where they find evidence for quantum Hall phases of the fluid, where in a superfluid where you don't have magnetic fields, you don't have charge, but what plays the role of the magnetic field there and gives you a gap in the spectrum and all of that is the rotation or the vorticity of the fluid. Okay, so just to get oriented with my notation, let's spend one slide on the simplest case, ADS Schwarzschild. Okay, this familiar black hole metric. If you do the Pfefferman-Gram expansion, it's very easy, it's a standard case. And if you put it into the form that I'm describing it here, this Randers coframe is just given by dt and dx. And, there was a quantity kappa that is a normalization factor between what I called FA and the stress tensor, and that's just set by the mass of the black hole. And if you compare to the general formula, this Randers one form is zero, and hence the fluid is irrotational. So it's just a non-rotating fluid in the boundary. Another sort of familiar example is the ADS Kerr solution. Okay, here I've written it in some coordinates which are not quite the Pfefferman-Gram coordinates, but there's a rotation parameter, if you like, which I'm calling A here. And if you work through the Pfefferman-Gram expansion carefully, you find a boundary metric of this form. Okay, so you can see that if I write down the corresponding coframe, it's in the form that I advertised, where the Randers 1 form has that form. Okay, and hence the vorticity is non-zero. Okay, that's good. So it's a rotating fluid. And this is, the vorticity is nice. It's well defined everywhere on the sphere on the boundary.
Delta? I flashed by this very quickly. So delta theta and delta are functions that appear. This is essentially the same spin rotation. So yeah, so this is some function of theta that depends on the rotation parameter A, but it's this guy that determines the vorticity. C is just a constant that depends on A. Okay. And this is a nice smooth two-form on the sphere.
Okay, so let's think now about ADS Taubnut. It's a similar sort of solution. It no longer has a rotation parameter like A in it, at least the case that I'm going to consider here doesn't have such a parameter. But there is another parameter, which I'm going to denote by N here, which is the so-called nut charge. Okay, and this is a solution that has various peculiar properties. It has, first of all, it has SU2 times U1 isometry everywhere, and I'm going to make heavy use of this at the end of the talk. Okay, it has a horizon and a Hawking temperature that are finite. And if we compare this to the Kerr solution, so there's this nut at the on the horizon, if you like, at the horizon there's a zero dimensional locus, and that occurs at the south pole of the sphere at theta equals pi, and there's what's called a Misner string singularity emanating from that. And if you think about this in terms of Kerr, in some sense Kerr is like a pair of, it's like a dipole of nut anti-nut. It's still axially symmetric. But the Taubnut is in some sense like a monopole. It has this string coming out. Now, what to me at least, it wasn't obvious though that if you thought about a holographic fluid dual to this solution, that you should think of it as a rotating fluid. But in fact, if you go through the Pfefferman-Graham expansion, you get again a metric, a boundary metric of a similar form. You have a Randers one form now of this form. And so the vorticity is non-zero, but there's a subtlety in the vorticity because this one form is not well defined at theta equals pi, right? Because d phi becomes ill-defined, and the coefficient isn't zero at theta equals pi. Okay. So if I think about the vorticity then, and I pay attention to that problem at theta equals pi, there's really sort of a delta function in the vorticity. And so this vorticity looks like a smooth piece, kind of like what we saw in Kerr, some detailed difference, but it's a smooth form. And then there's a delta function singularity. Okay, so this looks like a smooth rotation, like the fluid has a smooth rotation, but it also has, in some sense, a point vortex. And that's the boundary remnant of this Misner string. The Misner string goes radially out from the horizon out to the boundary, and it meets the boundary in a point, which in the coordinates I'm using is at theta equals pi. Okay. Now, a central point of my discussion is that in the Lorentzian geometry that I want to discuss here, this Misner string is physical. Okay, so you should think about the Misner string as sort of an analog of a Dirac string, which, you know, normally via the usual Dirac quantization conditions, you find some quantization condition that makes the string invisible, or that the bundle, that there's a well-defined bundle structure present. But if you look at, I mean, this has been known since the 60s, if you look at the details of how you might make that string invisible, what you have to do is you have to compactify the time direction. Okay, so I don't want to do that. I want to consider this geometry as is, and I want to try to interpret this holographically. Okay, another aspect of this geometry, as I said at the beginning, is that there's a region of closed time-like curves, and these surround the Misner string. Okay, and the point is that the phi phi, so phi is a compact coordinate, periodic, and if you look at the phi phi component of the metric, it goes through zero at a finite angle on the sphere. Okay, which is set by the nut charge. Okay, so there's a physical string there, but it's sort of cloaked by a region of closed time-like curves. Okay, so all of that sounds very bad. Okay, so if you look at the Pfefferman-Gram expansion, the stress current takes exactly the same form as we had in the other examples, right? It's conformal, et cetera. It's a perfect fluid form. And the fluid, as we said, has a non-trivial vorticity. And if, in fact, if you integrate the vorticity, that two form, over the sphere, the theta phi sphere, then you just compute the nut charge. Okay, so the vorticity of the fluid in the boundary theory knows about the nut charge in this sense. So it's, I like to think about that as it being sort of the charge of the vortex that's sitting at the south pole. Okay, now if you do the same sort of thing for ADS Kerr, what you find is that you integrate omega over the sphere, you just get zero, and that's consistent with this dipole picture that there's a nut, anti-nut there. And presumably there's a multipole generalization of this, although I don't know exact bulk solutions, but if you look at what's happening with the vorticity 2 form, all of the examples that I've given you are examples of Legendre polynomials. And so there might be, so presumably there are higher solutions that have multiple nut charges and hence vorticities that are involve higher powers of cos theta. Okay, but we're not gonna worry about that here. Okay, now I just want to expand a little bit on this metric that we obtained on the boundary in the case of Taubnut. In fact, if you so the theta phi part of the geometry at the boundary, you can think of as like a two-sphere. And if you go very close to the North Pole and you look at what happens to the metric, it becomes a rather simple and fairly well-known metric, which is called the Sohm-Ray-Chowdhury metric. This is one of these Gödel metrics, and it has closed time-like curves away from the origin, okay, in the coordinate that I'm using here. It's at long distance. It's actually those are actually beyond the limits of the approximation that I'm making in zooming into the origin. In fact, this is true. This metric is obtained there in both cases for Kerr and Taubnut. Okay, but if you complete the geometry for the boundary metric of Kerr, in fact, there are no CTCs. Okay, but Taubnut does have them, as I said. On the other hand, if you look at theta equals pi, the boundary metric of Kerr is again the same sort of metric. Where now, if you like, rho is like pi minus theta. But if you look at the Taubnut metric, it's somewhat different. The coframe looks like this. It has an extra piece here, and this is. Some people call this a vortex metric or a spinning string metric. And in fact, so one of the reasons that you might believe that you should interpret this Misner string or the endpoint of the Misner string as some sort of vortex in this boundary fluid is that it turns out that if you think about a vortex in a superfluid, and you consider solutions of a Schrodinger equation in an effective metric so you can reproduce the superfluid hydrodynamics by thinking about solving for wave functions close to the vortex that are in some effective metric. Okay, and in fact, the effective metric that you use, that you're led to by that reasoning that reproduces this superfluid vortex, is precisely this spinning string metric that that we obtained there. And indeed, if you go, indeed it's surrounded by a region of closed time-like curves. Okay, so this is an argument that there's a good reason to think about this, the endpoint of this Misner string, as being very much like a vortex in a rotating fluid. At least the geometry seems to be right. Now, there are differences though, because I don't have any charge here. Okay, so I'm not really I don't have a superfluid. This is just a neutral fluid. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Velocity goes to zero, or is it finite at the core?
This, what do you mean, the superfluid velocity?
No, fluid velocity.
So that, well, we'll get there. So it's to jump ahead, what happens is that the velocity tries to exceed the speed of light but it's not at the core. It's at the edge of the region of these closed time-like curves. Okay, that's what happens at the boundary of those time-like curves. Okay, so again, the idea here would be that instead of throwing up our arms and saying, you know, this region of CTCs can't possibly make sense from a holographic viewpoint, you might instead think that a possible interpretation for this boundary theory
is that there's really an analog metric in which you have, so you have a rotating fluid, and in this analog geometry ideas, you can have things like acoustic horizons where the, that was from the Olympics. So in this analog geometry, you can have acoustic horizons where the fluid, you know, the place where the fluid exceeds the local speed of sound. Or you can have optical horizons where the fluid exceeds the local speed of light. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to find some evidence that that actually makes sense. So you have to, in order to do that, what I should do is probe the holographic system in some way. Okay, let me expand. Before I do that, let me expand a little bit on some of the rotational properties of the fluid. So as I said, this Randers frame that we were led to just by the Pfefferman-Graham expansion is inertial. The acceleration vanishes. And what happens is that the vorticity shows up in a rotation of the spatial components of the frame. Okay, so the vorticity showing up here on the right-hand side. But alternatively, if you were an observer in the fluid, you might very well like to try to construct spatial frames by synchronizing clocks. And that would define what I'll call a physical frame. And I'll choose some frame that I'll call Z alpha that does that. And in fact, in the geometries I'm talking about, it's just in these coordinates, it's just linear combinations of the spatial vector fields. Okay? But these guys don't correspond with the spatial components of the orthonormal frame that I'm talking about. In fact, you can construct an orthonormal Lorentz frame where these are the spatial guys, and it's of this form. Okay, and this form has corresponds to a metric which some people call a Zermelo metric. And so this, as I said near the beginning, I mean, this nomenclature of Randers and Zermelo that I'm using is some old nomenclature. But it shows up in sort of classic problems where you want to ask questions like, you know, minimal time problems for ships sailing in a wind. And you can think about that in some effective metric formalism where Wi is the wind. Okay. And okay, so if everything was nice, this Zermelo frame should just be a Lorentz transformation, a local Lorentz transformation away from the Randers frame. And in fact, if you do that in care, it works just fine. Okay, I should note that this frame that we're talking about, the synchronized frame, is not an inertial frame any longer. Okay, so the Zermelo observers then really see a rotating fluid. They're not co-moving with it any longer. Okay, and this wind W is the relative velocity of those observers, if you like, at any given point. Okay, and good. So let me jump ahead a little bit. So what happens is that if you consider the Lorentz transformation between this Randers frame and the Zermelo frame, the fluid velocity, so that the if you construct the fluid velocity in the Zermelo frame, okay, it turns out that it behaves like that, and in fact it exceeds unity at some fixed angle theta. And in fact, this is exactly the place where the closed time-like curves occur when we think about the problem geometrically. Okay, so this is what's happening to the fluid as you go to where the geometry says these CTCs occur. The fluid is just trying to rotate so fast that it exceeds the speed of light. And in fact, this Lorentz transformation that I referred to, it's a local Lorentz transformation, it's theta dependent, and it goes singular precisely there. Okay? So the fluid is such that an observer can't boost himself into this synchronous frame globally in Taubnut. In care, these things aren't true. He can do that globally. There are no CTCs, et cetera. Okay. Well, we had this Zermelo frame. We had this Zermelo metric. Okay, let me compare that now to what people write down when they talk about analog gravity. Okay, for a system that has an acoustic horizon, they write a metric of precisely the same form. Okay, this is supposed to be describing sound propagation in a classical fluid. The sound velocity is given here, okay, and Wi has, as we had, is the interpreted as the local fluid velocity, etc. Okay, so in this idea that it's actually the sound, you know, the sound excitations of this fluid propagate along the null surfaces of this metric. That's the idea. Okay, and so because these things are very similar, and because we were led in the Taubnut boundary geometry to this sort of horizon where the velocity of the fluid wants to go to the speed of light, the idea is to just try to interpret that, as I said before, in terms of this analog geometry. Okay, so we replace this, so we interpret the CTC boundary as possibly an acoustic horizon. Okay, so we're just matching metrics at this point, right? But what we really would like to do is to probe the system and find some sort of more detailed evidence for this. Now, there's a little bit of work on this notion of acoustic horizons in the holographic literature. Schumet, Das, and Al Shapir, for example, wrote a paper a few years ago about what are called dumb holes, and because it's acoustic rather than optical. And they thought about engineering holographic geometries that have boundary metrics with an acoustic horizon. Okay, and if you consider some, in that case, the geometries they considered were much simpler than the sort of spherical geometries that I'm considering here. But they have some nice features that if you put in some plane wave excitation, you see that it has some sort of characteristic behavior at the acoustic horizon. The modes all want to go in. Okay. Now, what I don't have in my story, so these guys set this up to be interpreted this way, I'm sort of coming at it again from the opposite direction. I'd like to be led to this interpretation. Okay, so what I'm going to do in the rest of my time is try to describe some simple initial attempts to understand a little bit about this. As Rob tells us, we really should go on eventually and consider things like dissipation. That's certainly an important part of the physics. In any case, the first thing that you might think about, well, okay, so you would like to probe this geometry in some way, and maybe the best thing to do would be just to fluctuate the metric of this black hole and see how the boundary fluid behaves. That's a complicated problem, so it's much simpler just to try to probe the geometry with a scalar field. Okay, so that's what we'll consider here. Now, recall that Taubnut has this big isometry group, SU2. I wrote it as SU2 times U1, but that's a mistake. It's not U1, it's SU2 times R. And the reason for that is that R is that this part of the isometry is just the time translation. Okay, and that's as I argued before, I really want to consider that as non-compact in the geometry that I'm considering. Okay, so I'm going to write the generators of this isometry. The reason I'm doing this is that because I have this isometry, I should really use it to organize the discussion of this scalar field or any other field. Okay, and the generators in the coordinates I'm using look like this. I'm going to introduce a coordinate x, which is just sine squared theta over 2. So it lives on the interval between 0 and 1. X equals 0 is the north pole, and x equals 1 is the south pole. And you remember that this Misner string was at x equals 1 then in this coordinate. Okay, so L3 and L plus and minus are the generators of the SU2. But you see that this SU2 times R is twisted. They're twisted together. It's not just a simple product because there are time derivatives that occur in L3 and also in the raising and lowering operators, okay, whenever the nut charge is non-zero. Okay. So what this means is if you think about the orbits of this SU2 in space-time, they're not going to be closed curves, they're not circles, they're actually helices. Okay, so they're not closed. Okay, so this is just a helix, right? Okay, now let me just try to do what we would normally do. We consider a bulk scalar field. We write down the Klein-Gordon equation, the massive Klein-Gordon equation, and try to understand all of the solutions. Okay, it turns out this is an interesting problem. So let me denote by m the eigenvalue of L3 and omega the eigenvalue of H, the R generator. Okay, because of this twisting then, the solution appears like this. The phi mode is shifted by n times omega. And just for brevity, I'm going to introduce capital omega, which is just this product. Okay, so the resulting, so if you do that expansion in the phi and t modes, you write down the Klein-Gordon equation for a mass mu in this geometry, it takes this form. And what I've denoted C here is a differential operator, which in fact is just the SU2 Casimir. Okay. So one of the things that Finn, if you were at Finn's talk yesterday, he liked very much was a separability feature. Okay, and I've written this in such a way that, in fact, it is separable. Okay, in fact, it's separable for any value of the mass. Okay, so we can write the solutions in this form. Apparently we can separate the R and the X behavior in the solutions. Okay. I believe this is not trivial for reasons that I will come to. So you should keep that in mind. Okay, so what do the separated equations look like? Well, the angular equation just looks like the familiar form. I've called the separation constant lambda, and so the eigenvalue of the operator C is lambda plus omega squared. I'm going to choose to write that as, well, people usually use L, but I'm going to use Q, so it's Q plus 1. Okay, and then the radial equation depends on the mass. Okay, it also depends on omega, but it doesn't. But I've separated in such a way that it doesn't depend on the magnetic quantum under M. Okay, so the solutions here you should think of as like some sort of deformed spherical harmonics. They form representations of SU2. I know what the generators of SU2 are. You can write down the solutions. Here they are. They're hypergeometrics. Okay, and you can carefully work out how, for example, L plus and L minus act on these functions, and they do just as you would expect. They shift M by plus or minus 1. Okay, but you notice that the arguments of this hypergeometric depend on this omega parameter here. So this is the sense in which it's deformed. Okay, and it turns out that that's kind of a problem for the following reasons. Okay, so basically what I would like to do, this is the general solutions. What I would like to do is argue for some sort of quantization conditions to determine what parameters I can have here. As I said, I would, because this is a probe scalar field and my geometry is Lorentzian, I would like to be able to probe the geometry at arbitrary frequency. Okay, so omega should really, I really want omega to be arbitrary. Okay, well, the boundary space-time, as I showed you, is smooth at the North Pole. Okay, so it seems that it would make sense to just take the solutions that are well defined at x equals 0. And you can see that it will, that detail, you know, which of these is smooth at x equals 0 will depend upon the relative values of m and omega. Okay, so you can sort that out for various values of n and omega. Certainly for omega equals 0, so notice that omega appears in this equation only in the combination n times omega, or in this combination of capital omega. If I set omega to 0, then it just doesn't see the net charge at all, and this just reduces to the usual spherical harmonics. Okay, so at omega equals 0, you just have the usual complete set of unitary representations, and as I said, they form into SU2 representations, and everything's nice. They're also well defined at the South Pole. Okay, but what I'll argue is that for omega non-zero, this is problematic. Okay, so the first quantization condition that you can get is that this magnetic quantum number itself should be quantized. Now this is a little bit subtle. I can't rely on saying that it's quantized because of periodicity in the phi coordinate, right? Because the SU2 orbits are not closed; they're helices. The orbits just aren't closed curves, and so they don't have a periodicity property in that sense. But what I can require is that this group element, if I take chi here to be 2 pi, that this group element be the identity. I'm talking about SU2 after all. Okay, and so that does, so it's that notion that quantizes M. So M, if you believe that argument, then M will be quantized to be an integer. As I said before, L plus and minus shift M by plus or minus 1. And so in terms of the SU2 representations, what you'll get are finite dimensional unitary representations if Q is at least at the algebraic level, if Q is an integer, but you'll get infinite dimensional representations if Q is not an integer. Okay, so if you study, on the other hand, if you study these hypergeometrics carefully, so this is kind of a lot of analysis, but if you study these things carefully, at the South Pole, you find that the solutions are not normalizable in the Klein-Gordon norm unless omega is bounded. It's essentially set by the value of m in the solution that you're talking about. And if I have omega outside that range, then the solutions blow up at x equals at the South Pole. They're non-normalizable. And in fact, they're anionic. Okay? If I do traverse a circle at constant time around the South Pole, then the scalar doesn't come back to itself. It comes back to itself up to a phase.
I did have two solutions.
So it's the plus or minus here? I didn't write it as linear.
There's only one solution, which is non-singular at x plus zero.
Right. So that depends. So for a given choice of m and omega,
yeah,
what I did is I chose the solution that's non-singular at x equals zero. Okay. And then you study the properties of this hypergeometric. So how does this work? So let me describe how this works. So if you choose that solution that's nice at x equal to zero, and then expand the function you're going to keep near x equal to one, what you'll find are some powers of one minus x with exponents that depend on m and omega, actually m plus omega, and then multiplied by some factor that goes like one over some gamma function. And so what happens in the spherical harmonic case, if you start with hypergeometrics, how you get to spherical harmonics is that the coefficient of the guy that would blow up at the South Pole actually sits at a place where the gamma function diverges, and because you have 1 over gamma, the coefficient is 0. Okay, so what happens here is that even if you choose the guy that's smooth at x equals to 0, when you expand at x equals to 1, you find singular terms, but the gamma functions that are sitting in front of it depend on omega, not just on m and q. Okay. So the only way that you can in fact make that singular solution go away is to have omega quantized, to be an integer. Okay, this is what people often do when they consider such geometries. It's equivalent to what I said before. The Misner string is invisible when the time coordinate is compact in a certain sense. And when it's compact, the frequencies are discrete. And they're discrete in such a way that, well, when I probe the system with a scalar field, it doesn't see the Misner string. It doesn't see that singularity. But here I'm insisting on the frequency being anything, and so there is a physical Misner string, and the scalar sees it, in this sense.
Okay, but that's a problem. Okay, so that's a problem because what am I doing here? What I'm really trying to do is I'm studying this Klein-Gordon equation, and what I really want to do is just come up with a complete set of solutions, right? But what we've argued here is if normalizability on the interval from x equals 0 to 1 is your criterion, then such normalizable solutions only exist if omega is small. They don't exist for arbitrary real omega. Okay. Oh, sorry. So what I was saying before I was asked the question was that if you do go around at constant time, the South Pole for these solutions that blow up, the scalar field picks up a phase. So this is an anionic phase, and it's sort of consistent with this picture that the Misner string ends in sort of a vortex. There's a non-trivial phase when you go around it. Okay, so good. So that's the manifestation. It's the scalar field seeing this Misner vortex. As I just said, it's avoided only if you quantize omega. And you would get such a quantization if you insisted on your solutions being L2, being normalizable. But as I said, that's only possible that's equivalent to compactifying the time direction. Okay, so maybe the conclusion that I should draw here is that, in fact, you can't construct a complete set of solutions in this separable form. Or more generally, maybe this L2 condition on this interval is not really the right criterion. It's not really, in a sense, the norm that you want. Okay, one way to think about that is that maybe what I'm being led to here is that I'm really supposed to apply some boundary condition on the modes at this sort of horizon. Okay, in fact, let's think about these separable solutions. Okay, the reason that I separated the equation was that because it just sort of fell in my lap, and that's what you normally do, right? What you normally do with a PDE is you try to separate it. That's the first thing you do. And if by doing that you're led to a complete set of solutions, you claim success and you're done, right? But here what seems to be happening is that I not only have completeness in the sense of the functions on the sphere, but I also have the time direction to worry about. So I also have omega. And so what appears to be happening here is if I require the solution to be separable, I don't apparently get a complete set of solutions. Okay. In fact, if you think about the Klein-Gordon equation in that separable form a little bit, you realize that there's a problem here in that when you separate the Klein-Gordon equation, the full geometry, the full four geometry that you started with has these closed time-like curves. There's something sick happening at a value of theta. But when you separate the equations, the equations lose all notion of that. They don't consider that value of theta special at all. And moreover, if you think about the geometry if you think about the full four geometry, in fact, the region where the CTCs start is R dependent. Okay, so if I'm at different values of R, the separated angular part of the equation, you might think that you want to do something at the boundary of that region. But if you've separated the solutions, you no longer, that boundary of that region isn't a variable that occurs in the equation. Okay, so how can I make sense of that? How can I make sense of that? As I said, the Klein-Gordon equation doesn't retain any information about the CTC regions, but on the other hand, we haven't been able to find a complete set of solutions. So maybe that fact is just telling us that we shouldn't be looking at separable solutions, and that's consistent with this idea that this bad region is actually a non-trivial curve in the X and R plane. It's not, say, at constant at a given value of X for all R. Okay. In fact, one idea that I'm still playing around with is the idea that what we're being led to here, which I think, you know, sounds very physical, is that the bulk solutions that we really should consider satisfy some boundary condition along the boundary of the CTC region. And if you try to construct such solutions, because this boundary of the CTC region is a non-trivial curve in X and R in these coordinates, the solutions that you get are not going to be separable in, at least in these coordinates. Okay, so that's where I'm at. The hope is that that one can proceed with this idea and make physical sense of what's going on. The reason that I like this idea is that it's also consistent with this interpretation in terms of an acoustic horizon, that there's something physical happening. I'm forced to apply some boundary condition there. Okay, but there's many things that need to be checked here. This also makes it a much harder problem because it doesn't separate now into an ordinary differential equation. It's really, at least in the coordinates that I'm using, it's a two-dimensional problem now. Okay, so let me stop here with some conclusions which are redundant, so I won't bother reading them. Thanks.
I needed her when the tech was.
That's a great question.
That's all you got for me.
Yes. So if there is acoustic horizon in the boundary, do you expect to see Hawking radiation in the boundary?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, eventually. Eventually we'll get there. I think there was some evidence of that in the, I mean, that's one of the, in this analog gravity stuff, that's sort of the thing that they're talking about, right? They set up these analog geometries and there is Hawking-like radiation. That's sort of the whole point. That it really does look.
So what would be the signature in the bulk?
Would be the signature in the bulk?
Yeah.
Good question.